The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the Blue Cliff Record, Case 26, Bai Jiang's Sitting Alone on Ta Jung Mountain, the main case. A student once asked Master Bai Jiang, "What is the extraordinary affair?" Bai Jiang said, "Sitting alone on Ta Jung Mountain." The student bowed. Bai Jiang thereupon struck him. The poem. In the realm of the ancestors gallops the heavenly colt. Among expedients, rolling out and rolling up are not the same path. In a flash of lightning or sparks struck from stone, he retains the ability to change with circumstances. How laughable. A man comes to grab the tiger's whiskers. So we have begun our winter training period, and so our year is divided into these four training quarters that go along with the seasons. And so the Angos in spring and fall bring forth an intensity, an intensified schedule and practice for those of us here in the monastery and also for you at home, for those of you who are doing the Ango. And then in the winter and summer, that schedule lightens a little bit. And so there's a little bit of relaxation. And so on a weekly basis for us in training, there's the training week and then there's Hosan. On a monthly basis, there's several weeks of regular training and then there's Sesshin, our intensives. And then every quarter, there's a stepping forward into more intensity and then stepping back a bit into relaxation. It's a very important dynamic, a very important kind of pulsation that happens. Part of this is to keep us lively so that when we step forward into more intense periods of training, we're ready to do that. We're refreshed, invigorated, and because that's going to draw upon us to bring forth more energy, more effort, it's going to be more demanding, it's going to stretch us in different ways, and then there's a relaxation where we step back a little bit and let things relax a little bit. But all of that is taking place within the recognition that time swiftly passes by and opportunities are lost and that each of us should strive to awaken. That doesn't change, right? Winter, spring, summer, fall, we're all living within an impermanence. We're all living within our own worlds of dukkha. That doesn't change. And that's important to understand, to remember. Sometimes, you know, we're so conditioned, you know, to some version of a Monday to Friday, and then there's the weekend. Thank God it's Friday, right? And how we can live our whole lives in that kind of tension, you know, where we're living our lives and waiting for another time. And so to have these various kind of fluctuations in the schedule that are fluctuations and at the same time to maintain a constancy of intention, of awareness, of recognition that our lives are precious and fleeting. And that people are depending on us, whether they know it or not, to live well and to not cause harm. Of course, what comes along with the winter training period is winter. Particularly for those of us living in the Northeast, which I count myself very fortunate. I love when I came up north years ago. Part of the reason was because I wanted to live in a place of clear and marked seasons. And so winter is one of those. And Winter for some, perhaps for many, is one of the more difficult seasons. And we are seasonal beings. You know, we've been living with these fluctuations with the time cycles of the earth forever. And they have impact, you know, light, warmth, the shortness of days, the long nights, you know, it does not affect us. And so, and then within all of that, with taking place within the pandemic and the surges of infections and people becoming restrictions coming up again and people turning back more into their solitary spaces. And so, you know, this may be a more difficult winter than usual. It is, it will be already. But also in this way, because it's winter time. You know, speaking to so many people who are practicing within apartments, studio apartments, sometimes with children, family members, with little privacy, lots of things going on. So I've met some of you in Doksan sitting on your rooftop or in a park while the lawnmower drives by, or in a car, a space that you could claim as your own for a moment, and where there was perception, which is exactly what we do. We improvise. We work with what we've got. But thinking about that closeness of that space that many people are living within. And so I thought it would be a good time, and Hojin, since they mentioned this or suggested this when we were closing the Ango, we were having a conversation, that we really look at solitude during the winter as a sort of a subject of study. And I can hear some of you groaning, thinking, thank you very much, but you've had quite enough. but what is solitude, actually? In a spiritual sense, what is solitude? What is it within our practice? You know, in training, one of the characteristics of Zen training, certainly as we do it, is we're together a lot. We're practicing together throughout the whole of the day. We wake up together, we sit together, we do liturgy together, we have meals together, we go to work. We do that together all throughout the day, which is marvelous, powerful, important in so many ways in terms of actual training. And at the same time, physical solitude is important. It's an important thing, I think, as human beings. Certainly, it's an important part of spiritual practice, certainly for us in practice of the Dharma. The root of the word solitary is alone, which is made up of the words all and one. So that's really what we want to look at. What is solitude? What is being alone? And particularly when it's chosen, you know, we can put somebody in isolation, we can make them physically apart, put them physically apart from everybody. That doesn't mean they're in solitude. That doesn't mean they're alone. Not in the sense that we want to be looking at it. In this koan, Bai Zhang was one of the sort of luminous figures within the Zen tradition, 8th century Chinese master, studied with the great master Matsu. And he is said to have established the monastic rule within the Zen tradition. So we have our Doshinji code, the Kurenji code in the temple in the city, sort of the monastic rules, how do we live together? What are the agreements that we make to each other to live together so that we do that harmoniously and we do that in a way that is really conducive to practicing together? And so he is said to have brought that into the Zen tradition. And part of that was the movement towards Zen monasteries being in more remote areas as opposed to being around villages and towns and cities that made it easy to beg for food, which was the predominant way of finding support in Buddhist communities since the time of the Buddha. But a lot of the monasteries moved further out where that wasn't so possible, and so they had to become more self-sufficient. And so Bai Zhang is credited with saying a day of no work is a day of no food. Not in the sense that if you don't work, you'll be punished, but in the sense that we are all doing this, we are all making this possible for ourselves and each other together. And that, too, is a very important characteristic of what we do. That's why when people come to do programs, they always are part of caretaking. You know, and sometimes their friends, you know, look, hearing about this from the outside, say, wait a minute, you pay to go and do work? And it's like really not understanding the point that everybody is contributing to be able to actually contribute, to be a part of something, to help make something possible. And so the student comes to Baizhang and says, what is the extraordinary affair? That question alone should get our attention. Within an ordinary life, which is the life that every Buddha has ever lived, within an ordinary life, what is the extraordinary affair? Baizhang says, sitting alone on Ta Jung Mountain. If he was living in this monastery, he would have said, sitting alone on Mount Tremper, on Tremper Mountain. What is the extraordinary affair? What is it that enlightens the world? What is it that breaks open what is fixed, that illuminates what is hidden, that heals what appears as wounded? Sitting alone on Tremper Mountain. These words are easy to understand, but that should, understanding them that way should immediately help us to understand that there's something we're not understanding. You know, these teachings very often, certainly the koans, and so much of the teachings in Zen, are functioning on two levels. They're using ordinary language. Sometimes it's not ordinary for us because the language is of a different time and place. But at the time, it was ordinary. And in working with the teachings, we have to make it ordinary. We have to bring it into our own understanding so it becomes ordinary language so we can understand it. So it's working on that level, sitting alone on Tremper Mountain. But at the same time, they're functioning on a more transcendent level, a kind of level at which things explode. And that those ordinary words are vehicles to convey something that is difficult to understand. So in engaging these teachings as koan, if in doing that it doesn't shake our rafters, if it doesn't let some sunlight in, break off our shackles, then we're not yet understanding it. That's all. We need to continue and go a little deeper. So sitting alone on the great mountain, alone, all and one. Is it one or the other? Buddha's path is pretty clearly a solitary path. You know, it's said sometimes in the old teachings and the records that the Buddha's asceticism after his enlightenment was that he was never alone. Right, that he was always with other people. That was his form of ascetic practice. But in actual fact, it's said in the teachings that he would go off by himself to practice every day. And there are teachings that where he talks about how during the day he would be walking, traveling from one community to another, would be teaching, and then at night, and often throughout the night, he would be practicing. He'd be sitting, doing his meditation. So we walk this, what is in many ways a very inherently solitary practice. Zazen is a very solitary experience. No one can do that but you. No one can be in your mind and body and know exactly what you're experiencing. That's you are alone in that, each of us. And we do this together. It's said that when the Buddha was enlightened, he said, between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. And that's not, he's not speaking from some egoistic plane. He's actually saying what is true for each of us. And he was enlightened to that truth. Between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. It's also said that at his enlightenment, he said, I and all beings on earth together attain the way, the same moment, same time. Are those two statements the same? Alone. All in one. All beings have the same nature. There are many different ways of naming that. Dharmakaya. Emptiness. The ultimate, the absolute. Wisdom. And the 10,000, and that is what 10,000 things return to. That's what everything arises from. And in that place, there are no concerns, there are no things. And nothing and no one is forsaken. How can both of those be true? This is what makes Buddha Dharma, Buddha Dharma. To have an experience of emptiness is not unique to Buddhism. Other mystic paths speak of this experience. What's extraordinary about the Buddha Dharma is the Buddha realized that's not yet liberation. What happens when we turn outward? What happens when you've reached the top of the 100-foot pole? The peak of the mountain. And so we practice turning in and turning out, turning in and turning out until it becomes seamless, until there's no more turning. To be alone, physically alone, and to be with others. And to be at harmony, in harmony with both. In fact, when people apply for residency, one of the things that's on the application is, can you be in solitude and can you be with others? Are you able to do both? Because both are important. The Master Dogen said, from time immemorial, the mountains have been the dwelling place of the great sages. Wise ones and sages have made the mountains their own chamber, their own body and mind. And through these wise ones and sages, the mountains have been actualized. Through the body and mind of living beings, the mountains have been actualized. However many great sages and wise ones we suppose have assembled in the mountains, ever since they entered the mountains, no one has ever met a single one of them. There is only the actualization of the life of the mountains. Not a trace of their having entered remains. No one has met a single one of them. And there is only the actualization of the life of the mountains. It is not one. It is not many. It is not all. It is not one. All dharmas are forms of emptiness, each abiding in its own dharma state. And so Baizhang says, sitting alone on Tremper Mountain. The footnote says, majestic air over the whole country. Both teacher and student are defeated. Now remember what I said about the language functioning on two levels. So in ordinary language, that's they lost. Both of them have lost. True, that's another way of saying it. But on a more fundamental level, what is that saying? Lost what? Defeated how? What kind of defeat is this? And then the student bows. Often in receiving a teaching, there's a bow of gratitude, of having acknowledged, I've just received something. Is that what's happening here? Baizhang strikes the student. The commentary says, the student's bowing is not the same as ordinary bowing. Though they knew each other, they acted like they didn't. Though they knew each other. In a sense, what is happening in his practice is you're getting to know the mind of every living being. You're getting to know the mind of Buddha intimately. And in our own ways, out of delusion, as we're getting to know each other, still oftentimes we act as though we haven't ever met. We forget. This simple bow, is it expressing I alone am the honored one? Is it expressing all beings on earth and I attained away at the same time? Are these different? This is where the koans do not intentionally make it difficult. So this koan is not intentionally trying to make things difficult. It doesn't need to do that. We do that pretty well ourselves. But it's not intentionally trying to make it easy in a way that's not going to help us. So to make it easy would be to explain. For Baijiang to say, oh, what is the extraordinary affair? Well, it's when you do this and you do that and then you add a little of this and you take away a little of that. Got it? And we feel like, yes, thank you. Thank you for making it so clear, for telling me exactly what I need to do. It's all become very solid. You have really left nothing out. There's nothing left for me to do. The koan doesn't do that. We could say that the koan has a deep, deep trust in the student, more than the student often has. Trust to understand. And so in training, we go practice going to the peak of that solitary mountain, sitting alone on the mountain, the sacred mountain. This is where the practice of alleviating suffering is discovered. This is where the true nature of suffering is discovered. That's why it's important to let go of our suffering so we can actually finally understand what is suffering. Right? When we're concerned or really upset or caught in something that we don't understand, we're trying to figure it out. What do we do? What's going on? You know, and there's thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking and think. The more that I think about this, the more I'm going to understand it. And sometimes that brings a certain kind of understanding that is helpful. There's a different kind of understanding here that requires that we actually let go of that very thing we want to understand. Because that understanding is an idea. And then we become free to see it intimately. In the commentary, Zuedo said, observe how Matsu attained the great independence of freedom in just this fashion. Within the gate of expedience, sometimes he rolls out and sometimes he rolls in. And that's a phrase in Zen of talking about how it's a teaching style where sometimes the teacher is very, you know, supportive and affirming and very, you know, encouraging, because that's needed as we gain confidence, as we sort of begin to trust ourselves. And then there's a point where the teacher just begins to pull back, disappear. It's not so forthcoming. You're left more to yourself. He says, the wheel of potential has never turned when that boundary between inside and outside, between the one and the many is dissolved, then we realize that it's not turning. We're not moving anywhere. But then he goes on to say, if it does turn, it should go in both directions. If it is going to turn, turn it in every direction. Leave nothing out. And if it can't be turned, what's the use? Turning is important. Even powerful people have to know a little of changing with circumstances. So to actualize the one within the many, to be free and at ease in everyday life. These are the phrases that we hear over and over again, and we want to embody, we want to make them real within our life. How do we do that? This is how we do it. This is what practice is. This is what training is. but then we actually have to live it. Actually. And so we put a great deal of emphasis on entering into that still point, taking this seat, turning inward, letting go of all of our concerns, which very often means we have to go into the face of all of those concerns because they seem to not let go of us. They occupy our mind, right? And they seem to not let go of our mind. And so we have to develop our capacity to work together with those concerns, emotions, thoughts, anticipations, memories, to find our ease. And we have to go there honestly. Right? Turning the light around. To let go of our talking and thinking. To let go of our attachments to people and things. To let go of the many beings. To let go of all the crises in our world that need attention. So how is it at the moment when nothing and no one appears in your mind? From the outside, it can be very difficult to understand. How can that bring you closer to me? How can that bring you closer to the world? How can that make you more responsible? It can be very difficult to understand that. Because we're looking at it from a staunchly dualistic perspective, where there is a very clear inside and out. And that's why we have to have some faith and find out for ourselves. I was looking at some of the writings of Thomas Merton, the great 20th century Catholic priest, lived much of his life in Gethsemane Monastery down in Kentucky. Most of you are familiar with his writing. He had a lot to say about solitude, so I wanted to draw upon some of his writings because he's speaking clearly from a Christian perspective, right? And to see both the differences and the similarities. He says, some people have perhaps become hermits, have gone to the mountain, with the thought that sacredness could only be attained by escaping from other people. Right? That's a logical thing to think. But the only justification for a life of deliberate solitude is the conviction that it will help you to love not only God, but also other people. We might say that the only justification is that it will help you to realize Buddha nature, the nature of every sentient being, and to love people and life and the world. If you go into the desert merely to get away from people you dislike, you will neither find peace nor solitude. You'll only isolate yourself with a tribe of devils, others doing the same thing. And so that's why it's important to have a good intention, a right intention, to understand, because so many of us do come trying to escape the things that are causing us pain. And so it's important that we quickly or in time correct that understanding. He says, people seek unity, right? The healing of our estrangement, because they are the image of the one God, because they are nothing but Buddha nature. They are fundamentally not separate from a single thing. And because of that, we go seeking that unity as though because that is true, there's a way in which we know that is true, despite the apparent evidence, and we go seeking. He says, unity implies solitude. We might even say requires solitude, hence the need to be physically alone. And it's one of the kind of ironies or just facts of our communal life here in residency that we are so rarely physically alone in training. And so I want to talk about that at the end of the talk a little bit. He says, but unity and solitude is not metaphysical isolation. The one who isolates themselves in order to enjoy a kind of independence in their egoistic and external self doesn't find unity at all. For they disintegrate into a multiplicity of conflicting passions and finally ends in confusion and total unreality. And I think anybody who goes to the mountain, who seeks out a hermitage for these reasons, to get away, to escape from all those people who are causing problems, who are making their lives miserable, and to just go to a place of peace and purity, do not find that. What they find is all of those internal forces that have not gone away and will not go away just because they're planting themselves in that place. Solitude, he says, is never and can never be a narcissistic dialogue of the ego with itself. Such self-contemplation is a futile attempt to establish the finite self as infinite, to make it permanently independent of other beings. And this is a kind of madness. He says in a couple places, the need for true solitude is a complex and dangerous thing, but it's a real need. What is the danger? What would be the danger of solitude? He says that need is all the more real today when the collectivity tends more and more to swallow up each of us in its shapeless and faceless mass. That is, just being caught up in the mass mentality defined by media, by advertising, by images, by movies, by the stories that are being told, by the voices of experts, by the actions of mad, insane people who have great power. He says, true solitude is the home of the person. It's the place where the person lives. False solitude is the refuge of the individualist. Dogen says, make the mountains your own chamber, your own body and mind. And so in Zazen, even when we're sitting together, we are sitting in a kind of solitude. It's not physically alone. Although in the moment when you let go of all sense of time and place, when you're no longer bringing your attention outside of yourself, there is a kind of physical solitude that happens here in the Zendo. And there is a different physical solitude that happens when we're actually physically alone. That is important. I mean, you just have to think, before the world got so crowded, that was much easier to do. He says, we are constituted by a uniquely subsisting capacity to love. And for us, that means to have compassion, a boundless compassion, the compassion of Avalokiteshvara, right? That endeavors to, and in its perfect form, sees all things as equal. And that is based in wisdom, in the realization of selflessness. And he says, this capacity is destroyed by the loss of our perspective, by our delusion, by our false views, but not understanding what's real. And so he says, without a certain element of solitude, there can be no compassion, because a person becomes lost in the wheels of a social machine where they're no longer aware of actual human needs as a matter of personal responsibility. It's very interesting that he brings that in, equates the need to extricate ourselves from the machinery, right, of our distraction, the machinery of our discontent, of our engineered dissatisfaction, always, always looking for something, something, something to occupy our attention, something to distract us, something to give us a pleasurable feeling. Then we become lost and no longer aware of what we actually need, which is a matter of our personal responsibility. In other words, to be responsible to ourselves is to know what we need. He says we can actually escape from people by plunging into the midst of a crowd. Going into the desert not to escape other people, but in order to find them, people, humanity, community, communion, unity. And to think of this as a need, which is not, you know, we may think of this as very important, and yet we may let go of this before we let go of lots of other things. We may turn away from our practice, turn away from the Dharma, but continue to be very diligent and responsible and attentive and devoted to many other things. And not because we're necessarily irresponsible people, but because perhaps that sense of this as an actual need has not yet fully come home. It's not fully understood, perceived, actually. And that's understandable because it's subtle, more subtle perhaps, because it's not valued really. So there's, you know, if we're not encouraging ourselves, will we get some encouragement from our teachers, from the Sangha? But where else, you know? Sometimes students will say that, you know, when they're starting to get a little edgy, a little impatient, that their loved one or their children will say, you know, why don't you go sit? Why don't you go meditate? They get the need. It's something worth, I think, contemplating, you know, particularly, you know, within monastic training, it's, you know, we live together, we live within a framing, we call it a schedule, which is just a decision we have made about how we're going to put our day together. What are the things that we want to make sure are included every day? What are the things that are really important? But so that we make sure for those things that are important every day. Other things we might do less frequently, but still with frequency. Right? So there's a kind of discernment, a kind of prioritizing. You know, that while fundamentally all things are equal, in our actual experience, in our development, different practices are not equal. They have different weight. They have different kinds of power. He says again, physical solitude has its dangers, but we must not exaggerate them. What are the dangers? He says, there's no more dangerous solitude than one lost in a crowd who doesn't know they're alone and at the same time doesn't function within the community. They know neither solitude nor contact. There's no more dangerous person. I think this is actually and verifiably true. It's a kind of psychosis. At this point, the person is in contact with no humanity. Right? And so, what does it matter what happens next? Who would know? Who would feel it? Who would experience the pain of that? Who would feel remorse? That's why the Buddha said, without remorse, we can't actually liberate ourselves. Unless we feel the pain of the suffering we create, what's going to motivate us to stop creating it? We We could also look at that. Those dangers of solitude as using as a way to escape, using our concentration as a way to deny. I'm concentrating on my practice, so I'm just going to push everything else away. Misusing our compassion as a way to avoid anger. Misusing bodhisattva as a new identity. The danger of being in solitude and having nothing other than my own mind to hold myself accountable. How do I know if I'm actually on a true path? How do I know if I'm practicing correctly? How do I know if even real insights that I'm having are being integrated if I'm not actually relating to anybody other than myself? There's actually no more dangerous solitude than that of a person who's lost in a crowd, does not know that they're alone, does not know how to be alone, but who doesn't function as a person in a community either, doesn't know how to be with other people. And isn't that kind of what is happening here? Both of those things are being developed. We're learning how to be alone. What is that? What are our ideas of that? And what is the truth of it? And how do we live with other people? Right? We might think, well, I've been doing it all my life. Duh. Have I? Actually? Right? Being physically in the presence of other people doesn't mean I have been living with other people. Merton says, this person does not face the risks of true solitude or its responsibilities. And at the same time, the multitude, the group, right, the collective, the culture, has taken all other responsibilities off their shoulders. In other words, I just abdicate everything to my group. Tell me what to think. Tell me who to vote for. Tell me what is the righteous cause. Tell me how to respond. Right? Is that which we are seeing so much of, is that not the most dangerous thing? Because it really makes essentially anything possible. It turns insanity into sanity. It turns violence into patriotism. It turns actual education, uneducated ignorance, into a virtue. Mere living alone does not isolate a person. Mere living together does not bring us together. The common life can either make one person more of a person or less, depending on whether it is truly common or merely life in a crowd. To live in communion, in genuine dialogue with others, is absolutely necessary if we are to remain human. Which seems like a decidedly good thing to do, right? Maybe that's what is our primary responsibility, is to remain human. And that just being in a human form is not enough. This is why mystics are so important. This is why people who devote their lives to going into the deepest parts of what it means and what it is to be alive are so important. They are our treasures, our national world treasures, right? Who devote themselves so singularly to understanding things that we cannot understand by living on the surface of things, who take things that we take for granted, that we don't even consider things to consider, and present them to us and say, no, wait a minute, this is actually, actually important. Your life actually depends on what happens here. The challenge, of course, is oftentimes because they speak from such a place, their language has to be subtle, has to be nuanced. And so we can miss it. We cannot hear them. And really, there has to be an opening within us that is receptive to that. That is our bodhicitta. That's our beginner's mind. And for many, if not most, it won't be heard. It literally will not be heard. I see your mouth moving. I hear the words. I don't hear what you're saying. You might as well be speaking another language. He says, there's no true solitude except interior solitude. And interior solitude is not possible for anyone who does not accept their right place in relationship to other people. Again, he brings this home. Alone is all and one. Sitting alone on Tajung Mountain, the monk bows. Recognizing we are in an ultimate position of responsibility to each other. Bai Zhang strikes him. It's as though they don't know each other, but they have met. They are meeting. They understand. We must accept our rightful place in relationship to other people. And implicit in what he's saying is, we don't have to. Right? That's the vastness and the danger of our human consciousness. We can see or not see. We can accept or not accept. We can understand or not understand what is actually true, and what we are subject to right now, what we are living in the midst of right now, what we are suffering with right now, what we are struggling against right now. That can all be true, and it's like I choose not to care, to consider, to look, to contemplate. I choose that. That's, in a sense, the great pain of compassion is to accept that we each have that choice. We can choose to run our life off a cliff, or we can just choose to live, as Thoreau said, a life of quiet desperation. And no one can take that away from us. Right? It's why Buddhism cannot be an evangelical tradition. Right? You just can't do it. We cannot make someone choose the right path. We can throw out a lot of clues. We can, create a lot of, provide an example. There are a lot of things we can do. But we cannot change another person's mind. Merton says, there is no true peace possible for the person who imagines that some accident of talent or grace or virtue actually separates them from other people and places them above, or I would say below. Solitude is not separation, and maybe that's just the simplest way of saying it. It is not separation. And so I know I'm running a little bit long here, but I wanted to mention, particularly for those of you at home, that this week is we're celebrating Buddha's enlightenment, which is December 8th. And the way we always do that is with a vigil where we get together and we sit, starting on Friday night, through the night, through the next day, and concluding on Sunday morning. And so it really is a sitting vigil, and we will, of course, have meals, and people will not necessarily be sitting nonstop throughout that whole time. They'll be doing other forms of practice, but it's a practice vigils really in the footprint of the Buddha on the night of his own enlightenment where he sat on that Bodhi seat. And I was talking with Hojin Sensei and a couple of seniors this morning, and thought of doing it a little bit of a different way, in this spirit of true solitude, all and one. And in a certain sense, for all of these months, those of you who are joining us from your place have been coming and joining us here. And in a certain kind of way, this is a way for us to meet you in your place. And so the idea is that on Friday night, we'll begin with a talk, perhaps, or a fusatsu. I'll figure that out. And then we will spend that vigil in physical solitude. And the residents have done this before, but we will actually practice in physical solitude in separate spaces. In our cabins, in our rooms, we'll create spaces that become practice places so that each resident can be in a physical solitude throughout that whole vigil. And we will come together for meals and take care of things at a minimal level just so that we can take care of things. And so I wanted to throw that out as a way to invite you to join us in that and just to take up this notion of solitude in a new way, right? And I know many of you have already been discovering that because you've spoken to me about it, and I think to both of us and to the teachers, about discovering what that is because you've had so much of it and you've been doing a lot of practice during these months. And so this is a time to really take that up again in a more conscious, deliberate, intentional way and within this vigil. So if you'd like to join us for that, please do. The newsletter for the week already went out, so that's why I wanted to mention it today. And so that just to invite you and let you know it's going to be a little bit different than we've done in the past. We're talking about live streaming, perhaps the altar, which will remain lit during that period of time, if that would be a help to you at home, to sort of have that as a mountain to bring into your space. And Hojin Sensei is going to offer a little time for those of you at home about liturgy and how you might be using liturgy during this time as well. So please come and join us for that vigil to celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment, which we do by really sitting on that very seat. Okay. Okay, I think that's enough.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.